Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Ask the experts about free fitting on all our kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, one of our most famous writers, thinkers and activists, Dublin-born playwright George Bernard Shaw, lived a remarkable and a very long life from 1856 to 1950. And the amount he packed into his very public career was extraordinary. And this year marks the centenary of him being awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. So what of his life and his legacy and his engagement with Irish issues? Well, Diarmaid Ferriter is Professor of Modern History from UCD and he's here with me in the studio to tell us all about George Bernard Shaw. You're very welcome.
Morning,
good to see you.
Nice to see you.
So he was born in Dublin back in 1856, as I say. Tell us about his young life, his formative years.
I wouldn't describe his young life as a happy life. He spent the first 20 years of his life in Dublin and he did not look back on Dublin with much fondness. I often think he shared the scepticism that James Joyce had about Dublin as a city of paralysis. He found it lacking in charm and romance, and he said that Dublin's staple intellectual commodity was derision, and he complained bitterly about the blackguardism that went on in Dublin at that time. Now, he was very affected by his childhood. His father was, they were from wealthy stock originally, but they had come down in the world. He described themselves as the downstarts. He was a failed businessman. He had a drink problem.
His father was.
He had a drink problem. His mother was a notable amateur singer. So there's art and literature and music in his life. And he did find solace. He often referred to the importance of the National Gallery in Dublin, which he referred to as the cherished sanctuary of his boyhood. And he actually left one third of his posthumous royalties to the National
Gallery.
Which made a huge difference to the gallery. So he did appreciate that. And at one stage, his mother's music teacher, George Lee, buys a cottage in Dorky where he spends a lot of time. And he loved that part of County Dublin. He loved the views of Dublin Bay. And he was very captivated by Irish scenery. And he often insisted that that was what the Irish character was about. You know, that the Irish were not a race, that they were a climate in many ways. So he did have fond memories of that. He actually got the freedom of Dublin City as an 89-year-old in 1946. And of course, he had mellowed slightly, perhaps, with age when
he was
talking. But he did actually say about his time in Britain, even though he spent so much time there, that he would always be a foreigner there. So he did feel his Irishness, but he didn't feel any great attachment to Dublin. And he associated with the difficulties of his youth.
So off he goes to London. And he was a writer in the 1880s, but unemployed at one stage.
Oh, unemployed. And I mean, he's no overnight success. I mean, he's living on an allowance of £1 a week. He follows his mother and sister over to London. He's an allowance of £1 a week. He writes five novels, Claire, that are all rejected by publishers. He doesn't have his first successful play until the age of 41, The Devil's Disciple, which earned him about £2,000. So that was a very significant breakthrough. But what's interesting about him, he was a very shy young man. He said himself that his timidity was heartbreaking. And it's fascinating to watch how he invents a different Shaw for himself. And he becomes a very public activist. He's very captivated by the ideas of socialism, the Fabian Society at that time, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, very influenced by that. And he begins to champion some unusual and unpopular causes.
Mm-hmm.
He becomes a vegetarian. He said, "A man of my spiritual intensity cannot eat corpses." But it's fascinating to trace how he invented that persona, because he becomes GBS.
So
GBS and Shaw are two different things.
Yeah, fake it till you make it. Like,
yeah,
I have to be a persona.
Well, to give an example of that, Fintan O'Toole wrote a book about Shaw a couple of years ago, and he described a meeting of the Fabian Society, because this was a middle-class debating society about socialism and society. And Shaw gave a lecture to the society aged 30 in 1886 about his hatred of the family as an institution. He hated the family as an institution. He said it was an institution of tyranny and sentimentality and humbug and hypocrisies. And he gave a really forceful, provocative address. And then the secretary of the Fabian Society recorded in the minutes that this was one of Shaw's most outrageous performances. And the secretary of the Fabian Society was Shaw himself. So you can see how he's already othering himself. And it's almost a comical egotism. But it works for him to overcome that shyness and to become that very public intellectual and force.
Uh-huh.
And he is out there. I mean, he is preaching at Hyde Corner. And he is getting up on the back of carts, and you know, he has that kind of public persona.
But he's overcoming a lack of
confidence. Oh, there's no doubt about that.
So before that play was published at the age of 41, he was writing in journalism and various odd
jobs. He became
a
notable theatre critic, and he's very interesting in theatre, and he's very critical of Victorian theatre. I mean, what were Victorian audiences in London going to see? He felt there was far too much, again, sentimentality and contrivances and cheap laughs, that they weren't engaging with the big political, social and economic
They were enjoying
questions.
Themselves.
They were enjoying themselves far too much. And he was very influenced by Ibsen, and he believed in social realism. So the kind of plays that he is interested in are difficult plays. So it takes him quite a while to get a breakthrough, because he wants to write about identity and the big questions of society and how it's structured. And if you go back to, you know, his views on the family, his views on the way the economy is structured, his views on the status of women and the need for equality in society and the need for equality of income between men and women that's guaranteed by the state. I mean, these are very advanced,
very modern views.
Very modern views. And he also had very strong views on vaccination and themes like that. And of course, militarism, nationalism, identity. The way he put it is he wanted to point out the absurdities of the English class system and point out the absurdities of Englishness itself to the English people. So that's not necessarily going to develop a popularity for him, but he keeps plugging away at it.
Do we know why he was so unconventional at the time in his views? Where did that come from?
He was absolutely determined to become a fearless writer and orator. It's part of inventing that persona for himself. Where can I gain some kind of traction? What ideas am I drawn towards? And of course, he's bridging a kind of a gap between the Victorian England and the post-Victorian period. And all of these issues about welfare, about society, they're a part of the politics of the period as well. And then, of course, the First World War has a profound impact because of the consequences of the technological developments. And they were moving, as he saw, towards annihilation, the technological developments, faster than people could keep pace with. So this was a very dangerous time as well. So he's engaging with those themes also.
So at that time, 1916, the War of Independence in Ireland, Michael Collins and so on, what were his views on the Irish question?
Well, he gets into a lot of trouble for speaking out against the war. You know, common sense about the war. He published in The New Statesman, and he has very strong views on militarism and nationalism. And that's going to affect the way in which he looks at Ireland. But he defended the 1916 rebels on the grounds that what they were doing was what Britain would have done had it been invaded and conquered by Germany. And he was quite astute in seeing how the legacy would play out. The way he put it was that John Bull is now going to do things in a week that will disgrace it for a century in terms of the executions. So he spoke out very publicly against them, and he wrote letters to newspapers. He was always writing, he was always working, he was always voicing his opinions. He did want to get involved in penning the defence in the dock of Roger Casement, who was on trial for treason after the 1916 Rising. So he wanted to insert himself there. He was very friendly with Horace Plunkett, the Irish reformer and agricultural cooperative campaigner, who was involved in the Irish Convention, which was convened by the British government to try and bring unionists and nationalists together. Shaw wanted to be part of that because he believed in a federal solution. He believed that Ireland should come voluntarily into the empire but should have independence.
And these entreaties to become involved in such lofty matters, like, was he taken seriously? Was he welcome?
No,
in those
he
places?
Wasn't welcome. And he didn't get involved in the Irish Convention because that was not regarded as his domain as far as the politicians were concerned. And people like Churchill may have acknowledged that he was a distinguished man of letters, but they were not going to let him interfere with the political process. But he develops very strong views on the Irish question because it becomes a significant matter in British politics as well. He becomes friendly with Lady Gregory and encourages her to write articles about what's going on in the War of Independence. He visited Ireland 14 times between 1905 and 1923. So he is on the ground during some of those crucial and very violent periods. And of course, he abhors the violence and the militarism. But he's also someone who recognises the validity of the claim for independence. But as he saw, the true measure of freedom is what you do with independence. So what's going on between 1919 and 1923 really pains him. And he actually meets Michael Collins once and writes quite a well-known letter to Hannay after Michael Collins is killed in August 1922. Hannay was Michael Collins' sister. And he wrote her a letter in which he said he was not going to snivel over this valiant death of Michael Collins. And he encouraged her to tear up her mourning and hang up her brightest colours. And we should all thank God, he suggested in this letter to Hannay, that he did not die in a stuffy bed of a trumpery cough, inevitably disappointed had he been an old man by all of the failures of his life. I'm not sure how much comfort Hannie Collins got from that letter.
Well, I'm sure she was glad to get it, but...
he presented Collins like that. But his argument about Irish independence was that, well... let's see what happened to the infant mortality rates or the life expectancy.
Okay.
Or,
how did he feel post 1923?
He had very mixed feelings. I mean, he had mixed feelings about De Valera because he sympathised to a degree with his championing of sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't happy at all with the climate of the 1920s. And eventually he actually becomes involved in the Irish Academy of Letters, which is an anti-censorship group. And the way he described it in the 1920s is that Ireland was turning into this little grass patch in the Atlantic that was full of moral cowards who are, suffering under the tyranny of those who have all of these heresy phobias, as he put it. So that climate of censorship disturbed him. But he also had very strong views on poverty and the tolerance of poverty. And he'd written about this in Britain as well, about the levity, as he saw it, that existed around the idea of poverty. But he had also explored the Anglo-Irish relationship. You might be aware of John Bull's Other Ireland,
mm-hmm.
Which became a very well-known play in which, again, he's interrogating the assumptions that each have about the other side. So he continues to do that.
So then we come to 1925 when he's awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, which of course is 100 years ago this year. So how did that come about and why was it in that particular year?
That came about, I suppose he makes something of a comeback. You know, I mean, there was quite a lot of hostility towards him arising out of his opposition to the First World War because as far as he was concerned, both sides of that war were morally culpable and didn't have a monopoly on virtue. So there's a lot of calls for his books to be withdrawn and a boycotting of Shaw, but he keeps at it. He keeps producing plays of quality, and St. Joan, of course, becomes a very well-known play. It's partly inspired by Roger Casement, actually. And so it's during that era where he's achieving a high profile and a prominence again. And he's awarded that Nobel Prize for his idealism and his humanity and his writing that often has a biting satire but is infused with such a poetic spirit. And what becomes interesting about him is that he actually goes on to be awarded an Oscar as well in the late 1930s because Pygmalion, one of his best known plays, becomes My Fair Lady, and he mm-hmm. wrote the screenplay for that. And he remained until 2016 the only person who had won both the Nobel Prize for Literature and an Oscar. The second person, there's a pub quiz question for you now, was Bob Dylan in 2016.
It's just a remarkable career, isn't
it? Oh, it is.
When
and
you,
I mean,
when you look
I mean
at it
there
in
is that level of public decoration and acknowledgement, and he'd mixed feelings, of course, about these awards. But he also champions all sorts of unusual causes, like he campaigns against the existing alphabet as working against literacy and therefore the social mobility of the poor. He wants a phonetic alphabet and actually donates funds to that cause as well. And then he's this extraordinary letter writer and correspondent. There are over 250,000 letters in his archive. So he's working in this rotating hut he has in his garden in Hertfordshire to catch the light at different times of the days. So he's beavering away there, and he becomes an industry. He becomes a product. You know, GBS is something much bigger than Shaw. And of course, he becomes a very talented radio broadcaster as well because, you know, he bridges into that era also.
Many strings
to his bow, but also a recognition of the power and the reach of mass media. We talk about influencers today. He was the original and the best influencer.
Dermot, thank you so much. Dermot Ferriter there on George Bernard Show.